This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up tonight at 6 on 1A+, with near total abortion bans in 12 states, including our own, Jen White investigates the legal risks faced by those who facilitate access to abortions across state lines. Now, do you have a guilty pleasure when it comes to movies? That film that you love, even though you know it's bad, low budget, poorly acted, all of that? Many people found a new favorite in February when the movie Cocaine Bear debuted to moderate box office success.
There's something wrong with it.
Yeah, I told you there was.
Why is it acting like this? Did you feed it cocaine?
No, but you're safe. Bears can't climb trees.
Of course they can.
Then why are you up here?
Oh my. As the title suggests, the movie's about a bear that ingests cocaine and goes on a rampage. A dramatization of a real news story about a bear that died after eating a duffel bag's worth in the 1980s. It might not have been a very complex plot, but the $35 million project brought in over $23 million on its opening weekend, not far behind Marvel's big Ant-Man sequel. It's the latest example of an absurd low-budget movie seeing mainstream success, something that has been an important part of the Hollywood ecosystem for decades. We want to hear what you think and hear your favorite trashy movies. You can email us, ideas@wpr.org. Jocelyn Sepeniak-Galise is an associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, where she teaches a class called, you guessed it, trash cinema. She's also the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. I talked with her in March. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Lee. Thanks so much for having me on. I love talking about trash.
Good, because we've got a list here, but it starts with the latest, and that would be the popularity of Cocaine Bear. What do you think about it? How does it compare to the rest of the trash cinema genre?
Well, you know, clearly audiences are really looking for something escapist, right? When we want to go see a movie called Cocaine Bear. It's kind of funny because although Cocaine Bear has this image as a trashy movie, it actually kind of had a big budget. Not a big budget for a movie produced terribly recently, but $35 million, that's pretty significant. So it's kind of funny to look at that film in particular as a trash movie, because a lot of trash movies, they're really on the fringes.
Yeah, so what makes a movie, in your opinion, Jocelyn, so bad that it becomes good, or so trashy that it needs to be watched?
Well, I often tell my students there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. There's just... pleasure. I don't think we really need to feel bad about most of the things that we enjoy or most of the things that we're interested in. And as a matter of fact, this kind of trashy low budget cinema, it is completely entwined with the entire history of cinema. If we look all the way back into the 1920s, 1930s, very, very early 1930s, there's a practice called exploitation cinema. We hear that term and we think, oh, that must mean people being exploited, which is actually not what it means at all. It means the kind of, well, there's a few different opinions as to where the term comes from, but it comes from the idea of using advertising, which was called exploitation at that time. So really doing a lot of gimmicky advertising, kind of similar to actually what we would see with Cocaine Bear, right? Like lots of sort of gimmicks and like high profile advertising around it that's designed to get people into the theater.
Yeah, and Cocaine Bear seems to be part of a modern trend opting for some ridiculous plots involving fantastical creatures. The one that comes to mind here is the Sharknado. It's not even one. It's an entire series. It's a genre unto itself of sharks falling from the sky. It goes back to, I think, 2013. Here's a clip from the original Sharknado.
Every time it rains in L.A., everyone swears it's the storm of the century. And even if it is, Beverly Hills emergency services are second to none. We're safe here.
There are sharks flooding the streets. And now there's one swimming in your pool.
Are you kidding? Sharks in the swimming pool is impossible.
Well, I think you can guess how that ends. Now, Sharknado, never on the big, big screen, made for TV, but how much does the medium play a role in how these movies are received, Jocelyn?
the medium plays an enormous role. So to go back to, of course, I'm a historian, so I'm going to talk about the history of foul movies and trashy movies. Going back to the moment of exploitation cinema, which I mean, it's just wonderful. If you want to see wild movies, Sharknado is one thing, but try watching Dwayne Esper's Maniac from 1934 if you want to see something truly outrageous. I mean, that movie has actual cats fighting next to women fighting, right? So it's like an actual, you know, doubled cat fight that happens on screen. It's just remarkable. But that moment in time, you know, exploitation films, they wouldn't be shown in your traditional fancy, nice downtown theaters. They'd be shown with a practice called four-walling, where the directors and producers would rent out a theater for the night or for a couple nights. They might show even in like carnival tents at the edges of town. And this kind of points to then a long history of bad or trashy or outlandish or just plain tasteless movies being shown in theaters that are like on the wrong side of the tracks, right? They're a little bit vice-ridden, a little bit outré, and that actually just adds to the mystique of seeing something that's a little bit verboten, right? And then we just like want to see it because it's in this kind of like, ooh, this slightly dirty place. Now I really want to see this trashy movie.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Lease, associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, who actually teaches a class in trashy movies. So you're talking to the expert here. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We go now to Michael in Appleton. Michael, good afternoon. You got a trashy movie for us?
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So I was calling for a couple of things. I wanted to give a mention to some of the schlockiest cinema of the 60s and 70s with some of the blaxploitation movies, as well as the, I can't remember the name now, but like the Toxic Avenger. In some of those films.
Sure.
And then you already mentioned Sharknado. Some of the sequels to that are even more absurd. And then in my experience, I found that if a movie is a little more self-aware of the fact that it's very bad, it's more enjoyable often.
Oh, I appreciate that, Michael. Thank you for the call. Sharknado, not just the original, but the sequels. And there were some spin-offs, too, as I understand it. But let's talk first about the blaxploitation films. Where does that fit in the trashy film discussion, Jocelyn?
Oh, I'm so glad that Michael brought those up because they're such fascinating documents. First of all, they're like every movie, right? But especially like trashy movies or lower budget movies, blaxploitation movies are really a time capsule. Right. So if you're seeing these lower budget movies, especially from the 50s, 60s or the high point of blaxploitation, which is in the 70s, the people making them didn't have a ton of money for set dressing necessarily. Right. So you get a lot of stuff really shot on location in apartments that people actually lived in. You get like wonderful images of what New York looked at like at that time. So they function as this on one level as like a fascinating time capsule of the moment. But blaxploitation is such an excellent example of the kinds of things that trash cinema can do. And that's because trash cinema operates at the boundaries of polite society, right? Mm. It's like tasteless. It can be vulgar. It's outrageous. All of these things, blaxploitation certainly is. But at the same time, because trash cinema operates at the fringes, it can do things that mainstream cinema can't do. So with blaxploitation, even though, you know, it's not like moral cinema, right? It's not like, oh, we should follow all of these, all of the practices that everybody does in these movies. But they're movies where there's actually Black representation at a time that there wasn't, right? So they're a perfect example of how trash cinema can combine this very sort of outrageous approach with a bit of a political edge. So they're just wonderful examples.
And also, Michael mentioned The Toxic Avenger. The other movie that popped into my head when he mentioned that was Evil Dead. These horror films that are on a string of a budget and yet somehow gain, through time, over time, a real cult following.
Sure. I mean, The Toxic Avenger is, of course, a Lloyd Kaufman movie. He is the kind of more like 80s, 90s king of really trashy movies, heading up Troma Pictures that just made, I mean, the Troma movies are just like, they're disgusting, right? They're like absolutely disgusting. But he was one, he was a producer in a long line of directors and producers like Herschel Gordon Lewis, like Roger Corman or Larry Cohen, who are kind of like these amazing auteurs of absolute schlock. Right, like that is where Lloyd Kaufman operates, and I love thinking about him not as a kind of standalone figure, but as somebody who took inspiration from these other folks. Again, Roger Corman, Herschel Gordon Lewis, of course, who directs Blood Feast in 1963, which is one of my favorite trashy movies. It is trashy to the extreme. So, yeah.
Blood Feast. Let's go now to Kim in Brookfield. Kim, good afternoon. I understand you've seen Cocaine Bear.
Yes, I have seen it. My husband and I went to see it last week.
And?
2 weeks ago. Honestly, I was wondering where Hollywood's going with this. We were deceptive. It was very deceptive, the advertising for it. We just thought it'd be kind of like thrilling, whatever. I found it to be very, very gory, extremely gory. I was also a little taken back by the fact that there were like 12-year-old kids that were using language inappropriately, trying drugs. And even though it was kind of funny that they did it in a, not the way that, you know, whatever is supposed to be kind of funny. I don't think it was funny. I just kind of felt like, they were promoting some really bad ideas. And, we looked at each other, like, when are we walking out? And we just kind of sat there thinking, oh, it's going to get better. There might be a plot. I don't know. But and I really don't know if it was really based on a true story. I mean, none of that was really too real except for the bear ate.
Yeah, it sounds like you were a little disappointed by the film, Kim. And is part of this the marketing of Cocaine Bear, that it wasn't on the fringes, that it was on the big screen, Jocelyn?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what the problem is here, because when I teach trash cinema, we're not really watching movies that were extremely popular. They're really more cult movies. Yeah. It was something I found kind of mystifying in the marketing for Cocaine Bear, because it's trying to sort of walk this tightrope where it's got like a pretty good budget. It has to make back that $35 million. That's a lot of money to try to make back. So you have to bring in larger audiences, but then it's also trading on more kind of cult iconography, things like things that are shocking, right? Trash cinema deals in shock. That is its main calling card. So I was actually a little bit surprised by how this film was promoted. I think often when we come away from a movie, thinking that something was wrong with it, often it's that it didn't meet the expectations that it promised to give us. So I was a bit mystified by that myself.
We're talking about trashy movies and your favorite trashy movies with UW-Milwaukee film professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Elise. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Kim, thank you for your call. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Elise. She's a film professor at UW-Milwaukee, where she teaches a class called Trash Cinema. And that's exactly where we're focusing our attention this afternoon. With us today to talk about the recent success of the movie Cocaine Bear and the long history of bad films that we can't get enough of. And we're taking your suggestions and your favorites at 1-800-642-1234, where Karen in Appleton standing by. Good afternoon, Karen.
Hi. My family's favorite is the original The Highlander.
Yeah.
Very dark as far as cinematography. You can barely see what's going on. The acting is atrocious. There's hardly any dialogue. And the premise of immortals that can only be killed if you cut off their head. And the last immortals that face off to each other get all of the power that's been accumulated. And then they did, I think, two follow-ups on that, which were really bad. And then they did a series that was, they tried to clean it up a bit. But it's a family favorite. We go to it. We bought a copy of it, and it was still very, there was no lighting or anything like that. Everything was really shot in dark, shady hues. But my husband and I were on Netflix the other day, and they had it on. And we watched it, and they have gone back in and re-edited it.
Oh.
They lightened it up, and they added some scenes that were deleted. Huh. And, of course, the soundtrack is with, Queen. So there's some pretty good songs. But it's still a pretty bad movie.
Karen, I thank you very much. That's a Sean Connery flick, isn't it, Jocelyn?
It is, yeah. And I thought there could be only one, but that's a Highlander quote.
Nice.
I'm so glad to hear a shout out to the bad acting of trash cinema, because that really is a hallmark, right? We really notice the unprofessionalism when we see amateurish actors. And I kind of love watching bad actors in trashy films, because they speak to the way that trash cinema breaks apart the illusion of film, right? It's like we watch something that's this bad and maybe we laugh at it, but I think one of the things that we find kind of uncomfortable, and that therefore I find actually really generative and interesting, is that We no longer are completely immersed in this filmic illusion. Instead, we're starting to see real people. And that's when things start to get really weird and confusing. And I think that's one of the really wonderful things about trash cinema.
Could we add, since she mentioned the Queen soundtrack, could we add Flash Gordon to that? That's what made me think of it.
Oh, definitely.
not the best acting there either. Let's go now to Lucas in Jefferson, who joins us at 1-800-642-1234 with one of his favorite trashy movies. What do you have, Lucas?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So in college, I was introduced to the subgenre of trashy movies, trashy like horror films or slasher films. And so my favorite was actually, it's called Thanksgiving. And it reverberates around a turkey that gets brought to life and goes about exacting revenge on people who eat turkeys.
Now, why didn't I think of that? Long before it was Cocaine Bear, it was Revenge Turkey Thanksgiving. Are you familiar, Jocelyn?
Yes, but
really,
that movie, can I just talk about one of my favorites then? Because it really makes me think about one of my favorites.
Yes, please.
If we're in this theme of like eating and trashy movies, or like the revenge of the thing that you're supposed to enjoy, especially as a good American consumer.
Yeah.
From 1985, Larry Cohen's The Stuff, which is about ice cream that kills people that eat it. But it's so amazing, because in the beginning, like, I can barely talk about this without like laughing my face off. It's so funny. In the very beginning, there's a bunch of miners who just kind of come across this stuff bubbling out of the earth, and then they start eating it and realize it tastes good. And that's just the opening of the movie. It's just wonderful, but it's also a satire of American consumption habits, right? Like how what we eat actually like consumes us from the inside. But it's just wonderful. It's wonderful. It would make a great double bill with Thanksgiving.
Speaking of double bill, let's go now to Gary in Milwaukee, who joins us. Gary, do you have a trashy movie for us?
Well, I mean, I have a question. Yeah. I go back to the 1970s for this, but I'm wondering if the early 1970s, I'm wondering if some of these trashy films were reserved just for the unique environment of an outdoor theater. I'm thinking of one in particular, The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant. It was so bad, but so good. And there's also the Frogs, Phantasm. I mean, these movies, when I left the theater or drove out of the movie theater, I mean, I felt like I had damaged the way I perceived the world. It was such an experience to watch these things, and they were horrible, but I never forgot them.
And now
just for the outdoor theater.
Yeah, I'll never forget The Incredible Two-Headed Transplant, Gary, so thank you. And yeah, the old drive-ins, Jocelyn, and how it really didn't matter what was showing on the screen. It was about the event, the occasion, the evening, to just go somewhere and do something. How much do the old, since we don't see them so much anymore, the old drive-in play a role in the rise of trashy movies?
Oh my gosh, so much in the 70s, especially, right? Because you can have these kind of late night showings at the drive-in. They have to sort of fill time. I love the example of Phantasm, which is such a, I mean, that's such a bonkers movie, and it's a labor of love for Don Coscarelli, right? It doesn't quite work, but it just sticks with you. And the drive-in, yeah, that's such an important aspect. The other important kind of place to think about for 1970s trashy movies is a kind of companion to the drive-in. It would be a kind of like smaller theater that participated in midnight movies. And midnight movies, they were shown since before World War II. This was an kind of off and on thing that theaters did, but it really became popular in the 1970s. And there's one theater in particular, the Elgin Theater in New York, that really popularized showing kind of outlandish, trashy movies, starting with like El Topo, John Waters movies, all these kinds of sort of shocking movies that they would show at midnight and advertise thusly. And part of the appeal was that you would go to this kind of like punk rock situation and meet all of these fellow weirdos, right, watching these movies together. And I think it just speaks to how much the experience of where you're seeing those trashy movies translates to a deeper memory and a deeper kind of interest in them.
Well, our technical director brought up Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that's exactly what I thought you were describing there, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example that really, I mean, that movie has had such a sustained audience for so long because of how it's shown and because of how people participate, right? Yeah. It's only partially the movie. It's so much about the enjoyment that people have of getting together and experiencing it together.
Well, Jocelyn, I believe we're going to have to revisit this on another occasion because there is a lot more trashy movies out there than we have time for this afternoon, and a lot more that people really love, enjoy, and go back to again. So I thank you so much for sharing them with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much. Trash forever.
I'm with you. Jocelyn Sepaniak-Galise is an associate professor and the director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's also the author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship in Modernized American Theater Architecture. With us today to discuss why we love bad, trashy movies like the latest hit, Cocaine Bear. Thanks to everybody who called in and joined the show, and sorry to everybody who called in and we ran out of time for. I have no doubt we'll be revisiting this on another occasion. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin's young voter turnout led the nation in last November's elections. Rob Ferret will be back to explore what Wisconsin's doing differently and what's driving young voters to the polls. And also tomorrow morning, Rob speaks with the author of Hot and Bothered, What No One Else Tells You About Menopause and How to Feel Like Yourself Again. It's coming up tomorrow. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the latest on the Hollywood writers' strike now in its second week, and how it's affecting our entertainment and the entertainment industry. First, conservative groups have taken aim at libraries across the country in an effort to remove some books that might expose some children to material that they deem inappropriate or even harmful. Facing tight budgets, some are willing to go so far as to threaten to defund our public libraries. But the library can serve an important role as a cost-free, shared public space that provides opportunities for social and civic engagement, as well as learning. And libraries are just one example of the types of social infrastructure that strengthen our communities and reaffirm our interpersonal connections. The quantity and quality of our parks, coffee shops, places of worship, civic centers, and other shared public spaces can have some significant impacts on our quality of life. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. How do you feel about the social gathering spaces in your community? What do you love about your local library, your parks, event spaces, or other public areas? Give them a shout out. How do you use them? And do you wish you had more of them? Anybody want to make the case that they wish they had less? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Kleinenberg is the Helen Gould Shepherd Professor in Social Science, a professor of sociology, and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. He's the author of the book Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Let's start with some definitions here. How do you define social infrastructure and where do we see them in our communities?
Yeah, it can be kind of a wonky term, so let's make it simple. When I say social infrastructure, I'm referring to the physical places that shape our interactions. And the argument I make in my book is, you know, when we invest in them, when we design them well, when we build them well, when we maintain them, when we program them, we get all kinds of returns to our collective life. And when we fail to do those things, we become a lot more likely to hunker down, you know, stay home, be on our screens, hang out with people who are pretty much just like us. It makes our collective life a lot less interesting and rich.
The physical places that shape our interactions. What have the virtual places that shape our interactions? What impact has that had on our social infrastructure as you see it, Eric?
Well, you're talking to a father of two teenagers, so I might have a bit of a bias about that these days. You know, it's funny. A few decades ago, there was a social scientist named Bob Putnam who wrote a book called Bowling Alone. It was a very famous book about the decline of communities in America. And his complaint was, you know, Americans used to go out together and go to the big movie theaters and walk in the streets together. And he said, now we just sit in our living rooms and each family watches a TV show. Right now, an entire family watching the same show sounds like a collective utopian fantasy because most of us, we just have every individual on their screen. So I think there's a lot of social stuff that happens on our screens. I'm not a Luddite. You can find me on Twitter today. You know, you can find me on Instagram, all those places. But I don't really see the digital stuff as social infrastructure. It's communications infrastructure. But really what it works best at is helping us to find each other in real life. And here's how you know that that's true. Think back to when the pandemic was starting. Mm-hmm. We were all together on our screens, but we were home and it felt miserable. We missed each other. We missed gathering. We shouldn't take that for granted.
Yeah, the pseudo sense of sociability that you find in a Zoom connection. It's hard not to relate to. And when you talk about the family sitting around to watch a show as a utopian, I think of families that are sitting around with their laptops and headphones all watching whatever it is they want to watch so they don't have to watch what mom's watching.
Or even worse, when it's at the dinner table and you can't have a common conversation because people are sneaking their phones underneath. I mean, the screens don't have to be terrible and they can help us find each other. You know, if you live in a rural area, if you live in a small town, it can be hard to get out and find your people. There's some people, you know, who find lifelines to their community that can help them, you know, figure out how to deal with a rare disease or, you know, deal with a stigmatized identity that your parents don't honor and respect. And the internet can be great in those situations. But I think even in those cases, at the end of the day, our relationships are so much more rich and meaningful when we find each other in physical places. And really crucial for me is when we share activities, you know, we do things together. And I also think doing things together is a way that we can start to get at this horrible polarization that's, you know, driven our country apart. I know my understanding is everybody in Wisconsin just gets along perfectly. You don't have this division issue there in Wisconsin, I think, right? But the rest of the country, we're really struggling with this.
Eric Kleinenberg, our guest, director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. And we want to know what you think about your social infrastructure in your community and how it shapes your life and your family's life at 1-800-642-1234. And Eric, you've made the case before that these kinds of spaces can help reduce polarization and even inequality. How does that work?
Well, let's start with polarization. You know, there's no way we're solving the problems of Wisconsin or of this country on Twitter, where we basically get together and yell at each other. I think that the best chance we have for dealing with our cultural differences is to do different kinds of things together and begin to build relationships and recognize our common humanity. In the book, I write about the athletic fields as places where a lot of that work happens. I'm one of the many millions of parents in the United States who spend an inordinate amount of time watching their kids play sports. And it means that every Saturday or Sunday, I'm spending time with the same set of people that I don't really have that much to do with in kind of most parts of my life. Like, we're very different kinds of people. We come from different places. We have different religions and ethnicities and maybe value systems too. But one thing we do share is that we love our kids. And we love to watch them play these games. And we're happy to spend in huge amounts of time doing it every weekend. And so, you know, we start our relationships by talking about what's happening on the soccer field and our boys. And over time, we're able to share a little bit more. It doesn't solve all of our problems. We still sometimes disagree with each other, you know, but we recognize that we're human beings. And, you know, these days, unfortunately, that's a start that we need. So I think polarization is a problem where, you know, we're not going to get at it by persuading each other on the internet. We're going to start to deal with it by just doing stuff.
Your book, Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric Kleinenberg, our guest. How does social infrastructure then go towards reducing inequality?
Well, it depends on the kind of social infrastructure you have. In my book, I'm really primarily interested in more accessible, democratic, publicly shared spaces, and I'm less interested in more exclusive social infrastructure. I mean, social infrastructure can be polarizing and it can add to inequality. Like if you're in a place where your main social infrastructure is the country club, you're going to get to know people who are just like you, who are from your social class, maybe who share your racial or ethnic identity. And you're probably going to hoard opportunities and that's going to generate more divisions. But if the main place where you spend time is a library or a schoolyard or a park or a playground, you know, it's possible that you're going to start to build relationships that take you to different places. I'm a sociologist, as you said, and you know, we understand in the social sciences that a lot of our life opportunities, and especially job opportunities, come from our weaker ties, you know, not from our family members and our best friends, but people who we get to know who help us discover something that we didn't know was there for ourselves. And so we have to think about where we connect, with whom we connect, what kind of infrastructure we set up to build those relationships. That's why I've become such a big proponent of places like libraries and parks and playgrounds and athletic fields. They take us into the social worlds that we might otherwise find.
Libraries, parks, playgrounds, and athletic fields with our guest, NYU sociology and social science professor Eric Kleinenberg. How important are these spaces to your life and your interactions with others, to your understanding of others, to the relationships that you have and how they are built? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. How often do you go to your local library? And what about your communities, parks, or other public gathering spaces? How important are they to you, and what do they mean to your family? 800-642-1234. Our conversation with Eric Kleinenberg continues, coming up on Central Time. You're with us on Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Eric Kleinenberg, a professor of sociology and social science, as well as the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. With us today to take a look at the value of our public social infrastructure in our communities. And we're talking about libraries, parks, recreation spaces, athletic fields, and where we meet each other in the physical universe. Join us and tell us about it. Do you wish you had more public spaces where you are? Does anybody want to make the case for defunding these spaces or devaluing them now that you have Facebook or Instagram? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. And Eric, I'd be interested in getting your take on some of the attacks we've seen on public libraries recently and how that could negatively impact some of our social infrastructure. Eric?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, you cut out there.
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering about some of the attacks we've seen on public libraries, the content they contain, and what that means to our broader picture of social infrastructure.
You know, I find this very worrisome. When I wrote my book a few years ago, libraries were a place not only that we shared physically, but a place that I think we shared in terms of our values. They're a neutral space. And one of the pleasures I had doing research for the book is I went to libraries in conservative communities and also more progressive communities and found that people really celebrated their libraries. They liked hanging out in them. They supported them for the most part. And I have to admit that I have been shocked to see such a strong attack on an institution that stands for and represents what's best about an open society and a democratic culture. And I'm very concerned about this effort to ban books and to banish ideas, and in some places to defund the library as a shared institution. So I see this attack as being part of a more sweeping effort to make America less inclusive and less democratic. It feels authoritarian to me and dangerous. And I don't know where it's going to go, but I will admit that I see it as a very dangerous sign in our society right now.
Other than being a self-professed lover of libraries, what role can we play in supporting these social infrastructure places that are open to everybody?
Well, first, I think it's important for us to remind our representatives and also our fellow citizens how important it is to have a place like a library. And I often ask people to imagine that the library did not exist. Imagine there was no such thing as a library, period. And, in every community that's got a library, instead it had an Amazon store or an Apple store in that same space. Imagine what your community would feel like if there was no free place where you could walk in, feel welcome, get access to your cultural heritage without spending a dime, and have someone, a librarian, ask you, how can I help you? And promise to respect your privacy and dignity. Libraries play such an important role in our culture. In the pandemic, they provided Wi-Fi access for people and classes and all kinds of things that they did remotely to support communities throughout the United States. I honestly don't believe that we would be capable of creating the library from scratch if it didn't already exist. I think the idea is so out of sync with the way that we organize society these days. We wouldn't know where the profit incentive was and which businesses would want to support it. And we'd probably say it was unrealistic. But the reality is, we have this extraordinary institution. The American Public Library System is extraordinary itself. We have, big libraries in places like Madison and Milwaukee, and we have small libraries in rural areas and small towns and suburbs, and we shouldn't take them for granted. We should not take them for granted. So I guess the question is how should we support them, and how should we make sure that they're getting the resources they need to serve us? I think we're asking the wrong questions in too many places. In New York City, where I live, the mayor just said he wanted to cut the library budget by tens of millions of dollars to invest more in police. And for me, that means we become a less decent city and a less attractive place to live.
Eric Kleinenberg, our guest, we go to your questions and comments now about our shared spaces and the importance they have in your life and your family's life and the interactions you have with others in your community at 1-800-642-1234, where Jeff in Superior is standing by. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Well, I'm a good guy to talk to about this, because if you want to engage in activities out in the outdoors, we have, kayaking groups, we have running groups here in Duluth Superior, we got rock climbing groups, and one of the things I want to mention, we have three universities here, so sometimes they have speakers that come, and you can listen to them give a speech or a talk on a certain topic or a book or something, and then during the intermission, you get to meet people in your community, and visit with them about the topic. I mean, there's so much to do that for families or individuals up here in Duluth Superior, that there's really not a bored moment. You can go bowling or watch a movie, and you're always interacting with people up here. Four Starbucks in Duluth. So, you always meet new people. It's exciting to live in Duluth Superior.
Jeff, I appreciate the call. And you live in New York City, Eric, so much the same. But I think here in Madison, Wisconsin, having the campus in my backyard is something sometimes I can take for granted, because some of the public spaces that it offers, not just to the students or faculty, but to the entire community.
I think that's right. And, obviously the University of Wisconsin is an institution that has been under assault in previous administrations in the state, and a lot of people there feel nervous about its future and its standing. Things are better there now than they were a few years ago, but we're seeing big fights over what we like to call public goods, right? These things that we create that are that come out of taxpayer investments, because they're things we build for ourselves and that make our lives better in so many ways. So I think a big question for people who live in an area that has a lot of activities and has good social infrastructure is, are they as welcoming and accessible to everyone as they could be? Are there people who live in Madison who don't feel welcome on the university campus for whatever reason? Are there people in Manhattan who don't feel welcome in the branch library or in the playground? The United States does have a history of having built amazing social infrastructures that have signaled that some people really belong there and others don't. And sometimes we do that without even realizing it. So I think every institution and every community needs to ask, you know, what it's doing to make sure that it's keeping the social infrastructures updated and well-maintained and programmed, but also accessible.
Back to your calls now with our guest, Eric Kleinenberg. Cindy and DePere is joining us. Good afternoon, Cindy.
Hi. I have 2 points I'd like to make. One is that the libraries are more than just books. They offer so many things that people are unaware of. And our library, particularly the Long Green Bay area, a lot of kids go there because there's nowhere else for them to go. And it keeps those kids out of trouble. And my second point is that banning books is not a solution. You have a choice. If you don't like the library, you don't have to go. If you don't want to read a particular book, you don't have to read a particular book. You have the right to choose, not the right to tell people what to do. That's all I have.
Cindy, thank you so much for the call and the perspective. And when I think of banned books, I think of the movie Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which just came out, is hugely popular right now. And the fact that I got to read that book as a kid and how eye-opening that was to me and how some folks were upset that that book even existed on the bookshelves. And that it's just a small part of what the library can be for people, Eric.
Look, I think... First of all, I heartily agree with both the points your caller just made. And second, I think, yes, books that feel threatening to some people are offer lifelines for others. And I think we need to make sense of that and recognize that. I talked to so many people who told me that as children, the library was a place where they could feel at home, even when the world around them sometimes felt hostile. And many pointed to librarians as being people who really saved their lives because they helped them learn about themselves without judging them or intimidating them or asking them intrusive questions. They respected them as people. I mean, I can't tell you how meaningful it is for children to get their first library card and to recognize that library card is an acknowledgement of their presence, their identity, their belonging. And it gives them this kind of feeling of being part of a community that's larger than themselves. Not only they recognize, but they learn that when they take out a book like Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, or like Curious George or Harry Potter, they have to take care of it and return it because there's other kids in the neighborhood who want that book when they're done. And if they don't do it and the other kids don't do it, then they won't be able to get the next Curious George or Harry Potter book. And so we start to learn about what it means to be in a reciprocal relationship in the civic realm with people who are part of our democratic community. And there's not a lot of places that do that the way a library does. So there's just a lot at stake when we start banning books and defunding great public goods and social infrastructures like libraries. And I think it's a moment where all of us who share the values of an open society need to stop taking them for granted and start fighting back.
Eric Kleinenberg, thank you so much for your time and wisdom this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology and social science and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. He is also the author of the book, Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Sorry we didn't get to all the phone calls, but you can still sound off on this topic and certainly something worth revisiting again, ideas@WPR.org. He was with us today to help explore why our shared public spaces like libraries, parks, and civic centers are important to our communities, as was clear. Now, coming up after the news, Hollywood writers are on strike. What does it mean for the ongoing story of organized labor in the U.S., and what does this mean for our constant streams of entertainment? Don't touch that dial. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.